Good morning, everyone. It's great to see you. My name is Marshall McKnight. On behalf of Nassau Presbyterian Church and the Adult Education Committee, welcome to Florence, Italy. Our tour guide today will be Carl Fried Froelich, who has been here many, many times. He is a friend of Nassau Presbyterian Church, and while he is a Lutheran, we claim him. Under
no problem these days. We are in full communion.
That's right. That's right. I'll introduce Carl Fried in a moment, but first, let's pray. Dear God, we give thanks for this day, this special day, the first day of Advent and the first Sunday of Advent. We are grateful for the time spent with family, and we are so happy to be with our friends here at Nassau today. And we are grateful for Carl Fried to speak here with us today on this special day. We ask that you remind us and support us as we dwell on the greatest gift you have given us, the baby Jesus and the gift of grace. In Christ's name we pray, amen.
Amen.
Carl Fried has been here many times, as I said, and I remember fondly his presentation on his childhood in Germany. And it was a wonderful, wonderful presentation that I still remember fondly. And I know today will be a very interesting one. Whenever I'm on an adult education committee and they announce that Carl Fried will be joining us, I get very excited because I know we're going to go to a cool place and learn a lot. And today is no exception. Carl Fried Froelich, a native of Saxony, Germany, moved to the United States in 1964, taught at Drew University, and from 1968 to 1992 at Princeton Theological Seminary, where he held the Benjamin B. Warfield Chair in Church History. Carfield is an active member of the Lutheran Church. That's ELCA, right?
ELCA, yeah.
His scholarly interests include the history of Christian art and the history of biblical interpretation, a field to which he has contributed significantly through his teaching and writing. Please give a warm welcome for Carl Fried Froelich.
Thank you very much. Okay, well, thank you very much for the nice introduction, and welcome to everyone here. I probably know quite a few of you, because you may have seen or heard me before. It's something different. I decided not to do something I had done before. This time it's Christmas art in Florence. Florence, what a city. One of the great cities of Italy. It is characterized not only by the buildings there, but also by the River Arno. You can see it, right at the lower end on the left, and these lovely hills of Tuscany in the distance, a very rich area culturally, of course. Now, yes, there's a lot of Christmas art in Florence and from Florence, and we'll go into this in a minute. Where it is in Florence, of course, is an interesting question. There are lots of churches that contain Christmas art, and we'll just look at a few of them. This is the center, namely the Duomo. It's the cathedral of the town, a wonderful Renaissance building with a cupola that has no equal in the world. It was constructed by Brunelleschi in the 14th century, and actually still has held up. The Duomo is the structure in the back there. You see on the left the famous baptistry, which of course means goes back to early Christian times. Originally, it's an octagonal baptismal chapel, of which there exist quite a few, although this one is now much larger, was built in 1059. On the right, you have the Campanile, which is the tower And that was done by Giotto, with whom we will deal in a minute. But these are not the only, this is not the only church. Of course, there's a lot, there are a lot more. This is a Santa Maria Novella, a church with quite a number of wonderful artworks right in there. This is Santa Croce. Santa Maria Novella is the main Dominican church, and the other of these mendicant orders were the Franciscans. Santa Croce is the Franciscan, the main Franciscan church, and has quite a number of tomb monuments in there, along with, of course, other art treasures as well. Here you see this unfinished kind of back front of a church which is called San Lorenzo. This was the main family church for the Medici family. They actually gave a lot of money to this church, and it contains something like the Michelangelo tombe. That means this marvelous assembly which he sculpted for this church. Here is another one of these important churches, namely Santo Spirito, that housed basically the Augustinians, the third one of the mendicant orders, and it still has quite a few monuments right in there. The humanists, particularly, were interested in this. Coluccio Salutati, for example, is buried there, as is Boccaccio. So it means all the big names need to be on your mind when you look at these wonderful churches. There are lots of churches that you may remember if you've ever been to Florence. You certainly remember this one. That's San Marco. It is also a Dominican place, and we'll see some of the artwork in this one. It was, again, endowed by the family, the banker's family, and was rebuilt at the time under Cosimo de' Medici. So these are the main churches in which Christmas art can be found, but there are also a lot of museums. The main museum is the Uffizi. That's a word for offices. In fact, it was offices at the time when Florence was a duchy and later on an archduchy. So yes, these are offices, but nowadays, of course, these are all museum space. Here is one major museum, which is not only a museum. It is actually the center of the city at the Piazza della Signoria, because Florence had become a republic in 1115, governed by a governing body based on the on the trading entities in town. The craftsmen each had his or her own one. Here was the seat of the Signoria, and it's called the Palazzo Vecchio. It now is a museum, and inside you have a lot of wonderful things to see on all levels. And in front of it, on the right, there are two major statues. One is the famous Michelangelo statue of David, the other one is Hercules. On the left, you see the Fountain of Neptune. All of these, major artworks, of course, outside as well as inside. One very important museum is the Accademia, which actually now contains the real David. There's a substitute in front of the Palazzo Vecchio. The original is under a roof. right in here, and a lot more sculptures are in there, including the late Michelangelo statues that we have. Or here, this is the Bargello. It's looking like a fortress, and that's in a way that what it was. It was the police station during the major times of Florence. It now also is a museum, and it is housing all the small sculptures. Donatello, for example, the major works of Donatello are in the Bargello now. These are metal sculptures, as well as the Majolica, that means the earthenware art of the time. They're in there as well, the Bargello. But there are also some museums that don't look like museums right away, but they are. Like New Brunelleschi, who did the dome of the cupola of the Duomo, kind of built this little ensemble. It's called the Ospedale degli Infanti, because it was a house for orphans. The community cared for orphans, and he did all the artwork, including the designing of these very elegant areas, where he also put little round pictures of children. Inside there are some very famous paintings. So again, Christmas art, yes, if you even go to the Infanti, you will not be left without Christmas art. Or this major building, it's right in town. It looks again a little bit like a fortress, but it's not the fortress, it's the Palazzo Medici. That means it was the house, the abode of the Medici family, and was built by their main architect, Michelangelo. It has lots of art in it, paintings as well, of course, as statuary. The whole courtyard is full of it, and it's on a regular street there. It has a very odd kind of outside. You can see it's very clearly divided into three levels. The lowest level, that's the famous rough stone, which is used for a good many of the public buildings in Florence. That's a special feature, which always looks so little like art. But you just go inside and the art is everywhere. No wonder that Florence touts itself as the Christmas capital of the world. And if you look on the internet, you will see every one of their hotels has something to say about this. The last two lines here, can you read them? It says, everyone should experience at least this city once in his or her lifetime. So what you're waiting for? The invitation stands, and a good many people take this up every year at Christmas time. Now, this was not so in early Christian times and in other Christian centers. Earliest Christian art is found in the catacombs, and particularly in Rome. So, the question always is there Christmas art in the catacombs? It's unlikely in a way, because this is all funerary art. That means it's for burials. But, if you're looking for Christmas art in the catacombs, you would look for one thing, namely a woman holding a baby. That would be a sign for Christmas. Are there any? Yes, there are. This is one of them. And for many years or decades, people thought the woman on the right who holds a baby, that's Mary. No, it's not. Most likely, this is a burial of a woman, a family woman, whose life is shown in three pictures. In the middle, she is shown as an orant. That means a person praying. That's the way often the persons are in the catacombs. The people who are buried there, they are praying to God at this point. On the left, that's her marriage, the contract being made with her husband. And on the right, that's her with her first child. So most likely, you know, that's not Mary. But there is Mary in one instance. It's very hard to even see when you're in this catacomb, the catacomb of Priscilla, early 3rd century, that's quite early, around 200, 220 maybe. And it's almost not visible because it's you have to look up in a corridor, not well lighted. But it does show clearly a woman with a baby and a person standing next to her with the finger pointing to her. Is that Joseph? No, it's not Joseph. It's an Old Testament prophet, the prophet Balaam. Ever heard of Balaam? Well, read Numbers 24. That's a story of Balaam, who was told by King Barak to curse Israel that was, you know, on the way to the new land. And when he started giving his predictions, out of his mouth came, well, messianic prophecies, like there will be a star arising out of Jacob, and a shoot will come out of Israel. So he already points to this kind of event that will happen much, much later, and that's Balaam there. Balaam and Mary and the child, yes, in the catacombs. The earliest picture probably we have of Mary. Now, and that's not the only picture. In the catacomb of Priscilla, there's also this room in the back there, which is called the Cappella Greca, Greek chapel, and it is also painted with frescoes. And you can see on this first arch, there are three figures going toward the right. It's very hard to see exactly what it is. The other pictures in the back, for example, these are people sitting around a table. That's probably a depiction of a scene of a Eucharist, which was often celebrated at the anniversary of people who had died. But what you see here is, in a much clearer way, a picture of a person sitting on the right, and if you look closely, in her arms there is a child. You can see the head a little bit, right? Well, as an archaeologist, you need to look very sharply in order to see what is to be seen there. And there are three people going toward her with gifts. Well, it clearly is the scene we all know, the three magi visiting the Christ child in the arms of Mary. And of course, you ask, well, that's not a Christmas picture, is it? It's actually a picture of Epiphany, the 6th of January, right? No, it's a Christmas picture, because in early Christian times, Christmas was not on December 25th. That is a new kind of development in the 4th century. In Rome, first, that date was used in the 4th century. Before, Christmas was celebrated, for example, in Alexandria in Egypt on the 6th of January, which means Christmas was more like what John said, namely, the Logos has been born, becoming flesh. So the incarnation, that's the word of the word becoming flesh, was the important thing to celebrate. People were not interested much in birthdays. The pagans were. You remember Herod's birthday, bigly celebrated with a dance, famous dance. Early Christians basically thought of Christmas as the coming of the Logos. And That's, you know, why John is so important. You also know that Christmas stories only are in two of the four Gospels, only in Matthew and Luke. Mark has none of that stuff. No, that was not of great interest at this time indeed. And the question is, you know, how did this change? We'll get to this in a minute. This same combination of Mary and the infant child being visited by the Magi also appears quite a bit on sarcophagi. Not painted, but sculpted. And you see it here. This is the famous dogmatic sarcophagus, as it's called. Dogmatic because it was done after the Council of Nicaea, where the Trinitarian doctrine was finally decided as being the correct doctrine of God. The upper register here shows on the left God Father seated with two other people. It's the Son and the Spirit here Adam and Eve appear. Eve is being created, and it's created by all three because, you know, it's the Trinity that acts as God. Not just one of them only. And you can see God Father is shown here as sitting on a throne. Now look at the lower register. Who is sitting there? It's Mary, who sits there with a child in her lap, and the three Magi are coming. Yes, they come from the east. They have Persian trousers and a Phrygian cap. So yes, they do come from the east. And the one in front is pointing upward. On this little ledge, there are three little points, which are the star. So it's the star. And that's why it's quite clear who the guy is behind Mary. It's not Joseph. Who is it? Balaam, again. A star will rise. This was a very, very general understanding, and on a sarcophagus, no problem about that. Yeah, here you see it a little more closely. Yeah, the baby is a child already here, and because after all, he's the Logos, and the Logos is timeless. That's one of the reasons why the baby very often on medieval pictures looks so old. Not like a newborn. Well, I mean, it's because he's a Logos. Here, he already takes one of the gifts in stride, and they come with their pots themselves there. And you see the three little dots on top. That's the star whom they follow. Now, in the early Christian times, there are two major things that influenced Christmas pictures. You've seen now, the beginnings of what you have, a woman with a child. Balaam always plays a role. The visit of the Magi plays quite a role because that was ancient Christian Christmas. So it's a Christmas picture. And as I said, there are two things that influenced what happened with Christmas art afterwards. The first thing is that after Nicaea, there were other councils that settled other questions. A major one was the question, who Mary is. There were two sides. One side said she should be called Theotokos, which means a bearer of God, because the child she bore is God. Nicaea said it, 325, so that is the proper way to address her, Theotokos, mother of God. If you come to think of it, it's a very odd way of thinking about God. But yes, it has a definite impact on the understanding of Mary. So one of those councils, 431, decided that it was proper to call her Theotokos, God-bearer, not just Christotokos, Christ-bearer, which the other faction said. So once this was decided, you can imagine that the Marian cult just blossomed into the Byzantine Empire. And as you know, Eastern Orthodox people have in their worship service icons that they use for meditative and liturgical purposes. Every Sunday, there is on a little pulpit, when you come in, an icon, the festal icon of the day. And you're supposed to go there and kiss it. That's the beginning of the service. Icons play a very considerable role. So this was the first thing, 431, the Council of Ephesus that decides the Theotokos question. Yes, Mary is to be called the Mother of God. The other important thing was the popularity of a gospel which is not a gospel. We have four gospels, that's what the church decided early on, but there are dozens of other gospels which people made up, kind of, well, out of the blue. No, normally there's some base, how it happened that a particular gospel was written. One gospel was written supposedly by James, very important apostle, and this proto-gospel of James was so famous because it told a lot about the life of Mary, about which we know practically nothing. But people thought, well, there has to be a history of her. After all, she must have been a girl at some point. Where was that? Well, you just read this proto-gospel of James and you find it all out about her parents, Joachim and Anna, how she grew up, how she was a temple virgin, working on the curtain of the temple, and how she was betrothed to Joseph in a very odd way, by lot, so to speak, and which, all kinds of stories of her life. Now, of course, her life also includes the birth of Christ. So actually, this proto-gospel of James goes into detail about things about other gospels, the gospels which we call canonical, do not have. So this piece, written around 180, that means really quite early, was so enormously popular. In the West, it became known in a Latin form, which was a pseudo-Matthew, a Matthew gospel. They said Matthew gives you a little detail, but not as much as we need. And so this blossomed as well. These two things are the important elements that now develop the Christmas picture, the iconography of Christmas. Now here you see an early icon, very popular icon of Mary. She often is shown as holding the child close to herself and looking slightly off to the side. The understanding was, when you see this image, you really can get into what Jesus is. He is God and man. She actually bore him, Theotokos. She is the mother of God. This is an early one of these pictures. The normative one for Orthodox faith is this famous mosaic, which is in the Hagia Sophia in Istanbul, in Constantinople, if you've ever been there. It's just absolutely stunning, although it's not in the center. It's in the side corridor, but at the end of it, and you see it's a mosaic with real gold, of course, there. And she is holding her son, who has his two fingers up. This is a gesture of blessing. He blesses the whole world. And of course, that is the idea. She herself looks a little bit stern, and on top you have the writing. This is a Greek M and a Greek R, mater, mother. On the right, theta, T, and then an Y at the end, Mater Theou, the mother of God, Theotokos. That is the norm for Eastern iconography of Mary. Now, it's in the East, but it's also in the West. That's her again. And you see here, she is enthroned in majesty. That's why in the Renaissance, this combination, Mary enthroned, it's the throne like the throne of an empress. She's an empress as Mother of God. Of course, she is. And here, she holds her child, just like you saw in Constantinople. This is in Ravenna, Italy. Now, how come? Well, Ravenna was the capital of the Western Roman Empire, while Constantinople was the capital of the Eastern Roman Empire. During the 4th century, the emperor was living in Ravenna. And in the 5th century, still the emperor who united the two sides, West and East again, Justinian, he still cared for Ravenna. And the mosaics in Ravenna, the most stunning assembly of mosaics in the world, from that time, they were done under Justinian in the 6th century. So this is a Mary enthroned, a Maiesta, as it's called, the majestic enthroned one in the West. Well, in fact, yes, this is something that was understood after Ephesus 431, when it was clear she was the Mother of God. Well, then you better honor her, and she is honored. In this particular case in Ravenna, it's very important to know the context. Now, where is she? She's on a wall. And look at that. What does the wall show? It shows her enthroned there like an empress. An empress has a court. There is a court around her. That's what the angels are. Mary surrounded by angels. That is the Maiesta, the empress enthroned. And who's coming on the left? See that? The three magi are coming. Phrygian caps, as we now know. And this belonged to the early Christmas picture. It's not the case that the manger is the major thing for Christmas. No, early Christian understanding is it has to do with Mary, her own exalted status, and all the rest of it, with the Magi being Christmas picture, not just Epiphany. That split is later, not the early one. Now, not far from here, namely in New York City, you do have the cloisters. And here is a fresco which was brought over from Spain to be housed. They actually built a chapel at the cloisters to house this wonderful Spanish fresco painting. It shows, as you can see, the same thing that we saw in Ravenna as well, Mary with a baby, and the baby here blesses everyone. And she is in a mandorla there, and she does have a kind of a retinue as well. There are two angels. Actually, on the one side it says Gabriel, and on the other one it says Michael. So, the angels are her court. She is enthroned there. And in the West, this picture was called the Sede Sapientiae, the seat of wisdom. Mary herself is the seat of wisdom. This kind of image in the East, it simply was the majesty, enthronement in majesty. In the West, it was very closely connected with the idea of wisdom. Jesus himself is the wisdom. And therefore, yes, it's quite natural that in a church you have that picture to look at all the time. Wisdom is what you seek there. It comes through preaching and through the Eucharist. So that's quite normal. But you see there are three more figures, one on the left and two on the right. Do you see them? Who are they? Well, of course, the Magi. Yes, even at the time when they say the Sapientia, that means Mary as a throne of wisdom was the major thematic thing to look at for Christmas. The three magi are part of it. They very soon become kings because, you know, Psalm 72 says kings will bring gifts from afar, but you know, it's actually the three of them. Now, you do have also freestanding statues. The cloisters have two of these wonderful wooden statues of the Sede Sapientia, that is Mary and the child. They are carved and were painted. You still see a little bit of the paint on there, and they're fairly small. So they're mobile, they can be carried. Now, what do you carry? Pictures which appear actually in the apse of your church. Why would you have carryable Marys as Sede Sapientia? Well, one thing would be they could be on altars, on side altars probably, but they would not be stationary. So they also could be taken off there and used in processions. People in the Middle Ages processed quite a bit. You know, at service, you stood most of the time and you needed some movement. So actually, yes, there were lots of processions. And actually, in the early Middle Ages, there developed a custom that on big feasts, which lent itself to that kind of thing, you reenacted what the gospel of the day was saying. Like there were Christmas pageants that people celebrated, of course, with great joy, because a pageant always is something wonderful to have everyone participate in. Well, yes, they did that, and it is quite likely that at this page, at this pageant, when say the three now it's kings, the three kings come to Mary, there was not a real Mary sitting there, a girl that you know represented Mary. You cannot represent Mary, the Mother of God. So actually, they may have had little statues like this, which substituted for the real Mary when all the other persons, you know, were real boys or girls who participated in the pageant. So that may be a proper interpretation of these hundreds of small wooden Sede Sapientia pieces that we have from the Middle Ages. Along with this kind of major imagery of Christmas, they are also developed, however, first in the East, of course, a narrative a picture of the Nativity. The Nativity actually is a story, you remember, from Luke 2 and from Matthew 1 and from the Proto-Gospel of James, you know, all these extra stories that were around as well. And so actually, this narrative of Christmas also became picture. And it, of course, just like Mary enthroned, it is in, well, the front of the church or, you know, under a cupola. This one is from Constantinople in Kora, the Kora church, a very famous church. And it's the narrative of Christmas, which has a number of clear features, which always will now be used later on. You see the center. The center is the manger. It's not really a manger here. It's kind of, well, like a sarcophagus or like an altar. Well, all of this, very important. A manger is not just a manger. No, no. A manger is containing the Son of God, the Son of God, who is being celebrated by the church in the Eucharist every Sunday, and you know, who will be dying and then buried. So yes, it's all of this, manger, burial, coffin, and altar as well. Mary is lying on a kind of a mattress next to it, and all of this is not in a stable. Do you see that? It's actually in a cave, in a mountainous area. There's a cave. It's very dark in there. And that's where the manger stands. So actually, this comes from this apocryphal gospel, which says, no, he was not born in a stable. He was born in a cave. Well, was he? I don't know. But that's, you know, what the story is, and you can see it right there. It is. Joseph is here. He's sitting down there in deep thought, because as you know from Matthew 1, he was not quite sure that things were okay with his future wife. So he's in thought there. There are the shepherds who see the angel and hear the angel proclaim the good news. And there are the three magi coming here also to the same scene. The narrative, therefore, the narrative of the Christmas story in an Eastern icon does include the events of January 6th, along with what we would celebrate on December 25. So they are part of this whole picture. And on the left there, there are two extra figures. These are two midwives, because that's what the story in this apocryphal gospel is. Joseph tried to find someone to help his wife give birth, and he found these two midwives. They always appear in this picture of preparing the bath for the newborn. Now that actually is the Eastern icon of Christmas, which is exhibited even today in Orthodox churches as the icon for the Christmas Day celebration. And you see all these things which we saw in Korah in a very early picture here appear as well. This is from Novgorod, a Russian icon from the 15th century. You see the cave, ox and ass, both are there. Now, interestingly, this was a very interesting feature. It belongs to this picture because these are two different animals. One is the one that is happy about the birth of this child, and that should be the Jews who first heard it. And the other one is new to the whole thing, and we'll have to learn about it, the Gentiles. So the donkey is the Gentiles, and the ox, the steady one, is actually the Jewish part. That was an early Christian interpretation. That's why ox and ass are in there. They're of course, in there, first of all, because of two biblical instances, namely Isaiah 1 and Habakkuk 3. Then there's the baby in this kind of odd manger, Mary on the mattress, Joseph sitting down here. In the regular icon in the East, he is confronted by a kind of a guy in an odd outfit. He looks like John the Baptist. Well, it's not John the Baptist. There are two interpretations of it given. Some people say it's Satan who comes dressed as a shepherd and tells Joseph to be quite suspicious. That's, you know, one possibility. Another one is, no, it's Isaiah who tells Joseph, don't be afraid, because a virgin will give birth. So you know, you can take your pick. It could be either one or the other. It depends on who you are. And you see, again, the two midwives doing the bath there on the lower right. This is an American icon, as it's being used today. It says here, the Nativity of the Lord. It's still the very same image, the same icon, with all these features right in there. And that's quite important to remember, because this has now to do with what we go into, namely Florence. Back to Florence, after we know how the whole thing came about, what the theology of it is, and the narrative. The first one we will look at is Giotto Bondone, who was still born in the 13th century, 1267, and whose work was mainly, oh my word, yeah, we are really pretty late on. Well, let's go quickly through this. Giotto, a self-image from a Last Judgment, where he painted himself among the blessed. That's perhaps how he looked like. In Florence, he was the one who designed the campanile, that means the tower. But he, of course, also has a lot of pictures right in Florence there. One of the first ones is this Maestà, that means Mary with the child, her entourage, the angels, and it is the beginning of a really new time. He's at the threshold of the Renaissance and has influenced everyone after him very much. It's a new naturalism. This is not a kind of a stiff, holy picture. It is a real woman who sits there. She fills space, and she has a real face to look at. This is the Ogni Santi Madonna, an early work of him. He also has one of the narrative pictures, which you can see now at the Metropolitan in New York. It's Giotto's Nativity. You can see there are certain important features about these pictures in the Renaissance, like it's, of course, stable, but it's also cave. The two things are often together, stable because of the gospel, and the proto-gospel of James has this cave. Here, the very special feature is that one of the wise men who come, or kings who come, lifts out the baby from the manger. This is, of course, not very much in the Bible itself, but Giotto thought this is quite natural. It is something that actually should be possible, but both Mary and Joseph are a little skeptical about this. You know, take your fingers off that baby. I'm afraid there are the shepherds up there. There are the angels, the jubilant angels, and of course the animals are there as well. Now, what do we do? I'm only at the beginning of Christmas there. It turned out to be different, but at least it's something. Yeah, I'll just show you a couple pictures more with Giotto's. He also has nativities and the coming of the wise men or the kings in two sequences, where in the one he tells the story of Francis, and in the one he tells the story of Mary. Here you see this is the one in Assisi, where actually this one too. This is the one in Padua with the two pictures of the coming of Magi along with the Nativity. And here, this is one of the big pictures on the life of Francis. And I will close with that. The story is, the story is St. Francis wanted to celebrate Christmas the real way. So he got ox and ass and a lot of people to walk up the hill in Greccio, and there he celebrated Mass in the little chapel that his brothers had. You see them singing around here. And then he had a little box. And when he reached into this box after his sermon, there was a baby in there. Everyone was excited, and it was the first outdoors crèche in history. St. Francis made it possible for us to have our crashes today. So let's close on this lovely note, and thanks very much for your patience.
Thank you. Carl Fried Froelich. We have time for a couple of questions. No? We have no time for questions. Thank you so much for being here today. Thank you, Carl Fried.
Well,
next week, we will have Carmel Bujalin, who will talk about the Creatio Divina, the God who creates with us. We hope you'll join us.